So from integrity, what I want us to look at is that in healthy churches, we are real, we are not fake. We are real but not fake. And the words that we take from Romans 12, Paul says that love must be sincere. Now, in the original language, Paul used a word that would have been really familiar to all the people. When the people, the believers in Rome received this letter, they would have heard Paul use the word in love must be sincere that they were very familiar with. But Paul was really creative here. He used a very familiar word that's used in their contemporary marketplace, and he used it in a really unusual setting to teach a spiritual truth. And it must have shaken their minds when they first received it. Paul said love must be sincere, sincerous, and they would have been really used to seeing this word, because all the craftsmen who worked in marble and porcelain, who created all these works of art, would often put a sign sincerous on their work. So what does that mean? Now, if I was a craftsman and I was working with marble or porcelain and I was given this commission from this rich Roman person to create some sort of statue to go into their courtyard, and as I'm chipping away and making this fine piece of art, if I was a person of integrity and I was chipping away and making this statue and I chipped where I shouldn't have and I made a mistake, a craftsman with integrity would say, okay, got to start again, would put that aside and start again from fresh. But craftsmen who did not have integrity would pick up some of that stone dust, some of that fine dust that was chipped away, and add some wax to it and stick that onto the part that had been chipped or cracked. Now then this unsuspecting person who had commissioned the statue would come and buy it and put it in their courtyard, and you can just imagine the blazing hot sun of a Roman summer. As soon as the sun came out, the wax would melt and they'd realise too late they'd ended up with a dud. So the craftsman with integrity would hang a sign on their works, sincerus, which meant without wax. So here are these believers in Rome, and they get this letter from Paul, and Paul says to them, love must be without wax. Now you can imagine them scratching their heads and thinking, you know, in their little cell groups all around Rome, has our dear brother Paul lost it? What does he mean, love must be without wax? How can love be without wax? What does it mean? What does he mean by that? Well, I think we do know what it means. We know that love without wax is all these things, the genuine article, real, authentic, not hypocritical, not fake, transparent, fair dinkum. Don't you all have a wax detector? You can tell, can't you? Can't you tell when someone genuinely loves you or when someone is just faking it? Can't you tell? We all have a wax detector. I think it's really important that we use it too. But the thing is, and in the Living Bible, this verse is translated, don't just pretend that you love each other. And I think we are fairly good at reading it when people are pretending with us. But the trouble is, if we can read it, that means they can read it in us. What makes us think we can get away with it when we're just pretending love? So what is Madhubala Uniting Church like in terms of this? Is there love with or is there love without wax? What do you feel here? What would a newcomer feel when they walk in this place? The trouble with the wax love is that it tends to lead to pretending, doesn't it? We put on a mask. We put on a mask pretending that we're giving the love, but we might also put on the love so that we guarantee that we'll receive the love. Because if I bring the real me here, you may not find that lovable. So I better put on my good Christian face as I'm driving here on Sunday to guarantee that you're going to love me. But it's not real love, is it? Because real love works with the real person, the whole person. Can all of you really turn up here on Sunday? Can all of you turn up, warts and all, your frailty, your fears, your struggles, your doubts, all of you turn up here and believe that you're going to receive without wax love. So that's, if you're anything like any other church that I know, then this is a bit of a struggle because we're all sinners trying to live together, aren't we? And in sinners trying to live together intimately, it's a struggle to do this, but if you were committed to working on it, then one main way to work on it would be if we made it a definite decision that we were going to learn to trust each other, to demonstrate trustworthiness, how good are we at keeping confidences, that we would show acceptance of one another. So I would encourage you then to, this week, put that into action. So an invitation to transformation. This week, starting now, if you were to make a decision that you would be as without wax as possible in your key relationships. So that's the first pillar, integrity. The second pillar we're going to be looking at is, in a healthy church, we walk the talk. And from that we take charity. And as Graham explained to us in the kids' talk, it's love in action. It's not just words, it's actually putting wheels on those words. So some of the verses from Romans 12 that form this pillar are that we are to be devoted to one another, to honour one another, to practice hospitality. And in the original language, practicing hospitality doesn't just mean opening your home to others. It actually goes deeper than that. It's about opening your life, opening your heart to other people, letting others in and you going into their world. Now, it's really interesting that those first two pillars, integrity and charity, are really strongly linked to each other. We can't have one without the other. So let's look at that link. In Philemon, we read, I want your acts of kindness to come from your heart and not be something you feel forced to do. So that's the integrity. And then from 1 John, let us stop just saying that we love people. Let us really love them and show it by our actions. So you see the connection there between integrity and charity. It's about being real about our acts of love. And love is not real unless it's shown in acts of love. It's shown in charity. And charity is demonstrated love, love in action. So what are some ways we can show our love in action? And let's just start with two really simple ways, very, very simple ways which we can all do. So in the book of James we read, my dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone, right, so everyone, not just some, everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. I reckon that just in that verse we find some basic ways that we can demonstrate charity, love in action. So the first one is listening. How good a listener are you? I asked this of a woman once and she said, I'm a great listener. I've been listening since I was born. I think she made a confusion between hearing and listening. So hearing is with the ears, but listening, really listening, is with the mind and the heart. In fact, if you're really listening right now, your blood pressure has gone up, your pulse has gone up, your body temperature has gone up. Listening actually costs something. In fact, those people who work in the counselling field, the research is that 1 hour of entering into somebody's story of pain, 1 hour of that is more tiring than 8 hours of physical labour. It costs, doesn't it? It really does cost. And maybe that's why a lot of us don't necessarily want to do it. So am I really listening or am I just waiting for a chance to speak? Am I bringing all of me into this? I really would challenge you as I challenge myself daily. Are you listening? Are you giving that rare gift of love? That's demonstrated love. That's charity. And in that passage we also see about being slow to speak. Slow to speak. I wonder why it's so important to do both. Be quick to listen and slow to speak. I mean, what happens if we reverse that and we are slow to listen and quick to speak. What's some of the damage that can come from that? Well, staying with the book of James, you might remember that James talks about how just as in a large ship, something as tiny as a rudder can determine whether or not this ship is going to go on this great adventure or it's going to smash on the rocks, depending on where the rudder is heading. You might remember in the book of James, he says that in the same way, something really tiny like, just get ready for this next image. It's horrible, isn't it? Something as tiny as a tongue can actually set the course for how relationships are going to go. Depending on what we say, our relationships will smash on rocks, or our relationships will go on this great adventure. And James says, be very, very careful then about what we do with the tongue. That's why it's so important we be slow to speak. And you'll see underneath that a ratio of 1 to 5. Some research that's coming through now says that for every one critical thing that comes out of our mouth, it actually takes 5 positives to cancel that out. That's a really strong ratio, isn't it? I wonder what the ratio would be here if we hovered over relationships. So we need to be slow to speak and quick to listen. What happens if we're not? Well, I want to just read you a little story from a book we've got at home, written by Joseph Bailey, who buried 3 of his sons. I cannot even begin to understand that level of grief he would have experienced. So he wrote a book called A View from a Hearse, and he wrote this. I was sitting torn by grief. Someone came and talked to me of God's dealings, of why it happened, of hope beyond the grave. He talked constantly. He said things I knew were true. I was unmoved, except to wish he'd go away. He finally did. Another came and sat beside me. He didn't talk. He didn't ask leading questions. He just sat beside me for an hour and more, listened when I said something, answered briefly, prayed simply, left. I was moved. I was comforted. I hated to see him go. Slow to speak, quick to listen. These can be 2 basic ways we can each start to demonstrate love. So the invitation to transformation. This week, starting now, what if you were to leave here today? Well, actually not leave here, you can actually start at morning tea. What would it be like if you fasted on words? So you can eat the food, but fast on words. What if you were really intentional about speaking less and listening more? I really would put that challenge to you. So that's the second pillar. So how are you going with your church health check? The third pillar is that in healthy churches, we strive for unity. And as Graham pointed out, that word for that is harmony. And here are the verses from Romans 12 that make up the pillar. Paul talks about living in harmony with one another. Don't be proud. Don't be conceited. Don't repay evil for evil. As far as it is possible, actually, let's look at that last bit. As far as it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. What does Paul mean by live at peace? Now, a lot of us think that peace must be the absence of fighting. The only way we can really have peace or harmony is if nobody fights. The research says that is wrong. In fact, just looking at marriage, the research is very clear that couples who don't have any conflict don't necessarily have a good marriage. Sometimes couples don't have much conflict because there's something happening in that marriage that is not at all healthy. So, for example, I'm not going to fight with you if I don't care. Some people don't fight in their marriage because they're just apathetic. The opposite of love can actually be apathy. I don't even care enough about you or this relationship to fight with you. It's almost like, yeah, whatever. and back away. So sometimes not fighting is a sign that psychologically you've actually given up already. Or sometimes we don't fight because we're afraid of conflict. And I know some couples who will say, well, every time we talk about that issue, we fight, so don't talk about that. Every time we talk about that issue, we fight, don't talk about that. So before you know it, all these bits are chopped off and the landscape of the relationship shrinks until this is the size of the relationship. And no, you don't have any conflict in that little space because it's just small talk in that little space. You don't talk about anything that matters in that small space. So of course you don't have conflict. The trouble is, the lower the conflict, the lower the intimacy too. And other couples, they may not fight because it's not safe for one to disagree, and so they just give in to the other. So the absence of fighting does not mean necessarily the presence of harmony. The presence of harmony means that we show up and we try to learn to have the fair fight, the clean fight. How do we fight clean? Because the call on us is not to be peacekeepers, putting lids on stuff. And part of our role yesterday with the church council was to see if there are any lids and take some lids off and see what can come out of that. Our role is not to be peacekeepers. Our role is to be peacemakers, which is messy. It's messy to be peacemakers. Because it means that we deal with the real rather than putting lids on stuff. But that's the call on us. As far as possible, as far as depends on us, live at peace. But also we find in that passage, Paul says, don't be proud, don't be conceited, which this woman has to learn. So we found a poem about this. This is what conceit and pride might look like. I am the person in the middle, for wherever I stand determines where the middle is. I am prudent. Anyone who spends more than me is a spendthrift. Anyone who spends less than me is a miser. I am a careful driver. Anyone who drives faster than me is reckless. Anyone who drives slower than me is a slowpoke. I express my feelings appropriately. Anyone more emotional is hysterical. Anyone less emotional is repressed. I am kind-hearted. Anyone more so is a sucker. Anyone less so is cold and insensitive. I am responsible. Anyone more responsible is a control freak. Anyone less responsible than me is negligent. I am normally sexed. Anyone with more of a libido than me is a sexual addict. Anyone with less libido is sexually repressed. My politics are normal. Anyone to the left of me is a socialist. Anyone to the right of me is a redneck. I am a biblical Christian. Those on one side of me are fundamentalists. Those on the other side of me are liberals. I am the person in the middle, for where I stand determines where the middle is. Now, don't we all do that? You know, I think I'm normal. You're acting differently from me, so you must be abnormal. So get over here and be more like me. Don't we do that in subtle ways and not so subtle ways? But Paul says, do not be proud, do not be conceited. That is a form of conceit if I think that the way I read things, the way I am, is normal. And all the rest of you have got work to do. Can you see the conceit in that? But we do it so often, and we do it, as I said, sometimes in subtle ways and not so subtle ways. So, the invitation to transformation. This week, starting now, seek to be a peacemaker, to truly make peace with humility, which might mean dealing with some messy stuff rather than trying to push it down. Because the trouble is, when we try to push stuff down, when we're peacekeepers, it always leaks. It's like the wax that leaks in the hot sun. As soon as the relationship goes through a hot spell, stuff that's been put under the lid is going to leak out. The wax will always leak out. Last pillar. In healthy churches, we do life together. Just because we're sharing this oxygen and sharing this room does not mean we're doing life together. So the last pillar is empathy. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. Paul is saying here, make sure that nobody here goes through the best of times or the worst of times alone. Have you heard that saying, a joy that's shared is doubled and a sorrow that's shared is halved? We are called to do life together, which means in the hard times, in the good times, to actually be there for each other, to celebrate the good and to help carry the burden of the bad. To do that, we can only do that with empathy. And as Graham and the children helped us understand, empathy is being able to tune into other people's feelings. But see, it's not enough that you can read people's feelings, because psychopaths are very, very good at reading people's feelings. But the reason they read people's feelings is so that they can manipulate them. So reading people's feelings is not enough. We have to do the next thing, which is to actually feel with others' feelings. Psychopaths do not feel with others' feelings. So Paul is saying there, recognize, I mean, you can't rejoice with someone who's rejoicing unless you can read that, unless you've got emotional literacy. You can read another person's emotions. But then he's saying, don't just read it, then enter into it, which means entering into the world and life of the other, sharing in their story. Now, even the youngest of children show empathy. Aren't those pictures amazing? The reason even the youngest child can show empathy is because there's an empathy centre in the brain. We've actually got an empathy centre, and it can be damaged. It can be damaged by trauma, it can be damaged by other things, and that's why some people really struggle with that. So if we're born with an empathy centre, if children as young as that can show empathy, why does Paul then have to exhort us to do it? Why are we exhorted to actually apply empathy, to use it? Because it's hard, isn't it? Isn't it hard? I mean, we would have to make a conscious decision to read somebody, to read what's really going on. And sometimes that's not so hard, to read emotions. But people don't come like that, do they? We don't come with this really simple, by the way, this is what I'm feeling. We don't come with that. It's usually much more complicated than that, isn't it? So why does Paul exhort us to do this? Because, as I said, it's not necessarily easy. We would have to make a decision. We're going to read behind maybe the mask, read behind the mouth. The mouth might be smiling, but the eyes might be incredibly sad, to read it. But then to actually make the decision, I'm going to not just see it and walk away, which is kind of like the story of the Samaritan, isn't it? Seeing pain and then walking away. I would have to say, I'm going to see it and I'm going to choose to enter in. And that costs, doesn't it? It does cost to actually enter somebody else's pain. And it also costs to enter someone else's joy, because maybe you're going through a hard time. It actually costs us something. And that's why often what we do is we just put the mask on. How are you? Fine. Yep, fine. And we don't go beyond that. But Paul says in a healthy community of faith, we go beyond just those platitudes, the small talk, just the fine stuff, the first impressions, the judgment, and we look deeper. And one story I want to share with you about somebody who learnt about the danger of the first impression as opposed to going deeper is a story by Stephen, is it Covey or Covey? Can't remember. Covey, Stephen Covey. Just want to read this to you. I was sitting on a Sunday morning in a subway in New York. People were sitting quietly, some reading newspapers, some lost in thought, some resting with their eyes closed. It was a calm, peaceful scene. Then suddenly, a man and his children entered the subway car. The children were so loud and rambunctious that instantly the whole climate changed. The man sat down next to me and closed his eyes, apparently oblivious to the situation. The children were yelling back and forth, throwing things, even grabbing people's newspapers. It was very disturbing, and yet the man sitting next to me did nothing. It was difficult not to feel irritated. I could not believe that he could be so insensitive as to let his children run wild like that and do nothing about it, taking no responsibility at all. It was easy to see that everyone else on the subway felt irritated too. So, finally, with what I felt was unusual patience and restraint, I turned to him and said, "Sir, your children are really disturbing a lot of people. I wonder if you wouldn't control them a little more." The man lifted his gaze as if to come to a consciousness of the situation for the first time and said softly, "Oh, you're right. I guess I should do something about it. We've just come from the hospital where their mother died about an hour ago. I don't know what to think, and I guess my kids don't know how to handle it either." Can you imagine what I felt at that moment? My paradigm shifted. Suddenly, I saw things differently. I thought differently. I felt differently. I behaved differently. My irritation vanished. I didn't have to worry about controlling my attitude or behaviour. My heart was filled with the man's pain. Feelings of sympathy and compassion flowed freely. "Your wife just died? I'm so sorry. Can you tell me about it? What can I do to help?" Everything changed in that instant. So, the invitation to transformation. This week, starting now, what if you were to work on identifying, naming, and feeling with the weeping, rejoicing experiences of others? All of us doing that. So, how was your church health check? As I was going through those four pillars, how do you think Madribar Uniting Church is going with those four? Be really good if you talk to each other over morning tea about that. In your home groups, talked about that. And as I close, this is my invitation to all of us. A healthy church is made up of people behaving in healthy ways. We cannot be a healthy church unless each of us is determined to be healthy, and unhealthy things are called out. We don't do that here. That's not who we are, making those statements to each other. Because God calls us to be real, integrity, no masks, to demonstrate our love for others in practical ways, charity, demonstrated love, love in action, to be committed to unity, harmony, to be peacemakers, and to walk in each other's shoes, empathy.